I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome, or should I say welcome back, to the Indie Football Podcast, World Cup Daily from Moscow, where we have just witnessed two penalty shootouts in back-to-back games. I am Emmanuel, host of the Indie Football Podcast and sports editor of The Independent. And alongside me is chief football writer of said title, Miguel Delaney.
Hello. Well, good evening. Whatever.
And unfortunately, we have a sad Miguel Delaney today because it is with great tristeza that I must reveal that Spain are out of the World Cup in the most shocking news of the day. They were eliminated by hosts Russia, 4-3 on a penalty shootout.
5-3 in the end.
5-3 on a penalty shootout. After a game in which they...
Oh, no, maybe it was 4-3, because the last one was Aspas.
I thought it was 4-3.
Yeah.
After a game in which they dominated completely, not only completely, dominated to a ludicrous extent, but they
didn't do anything.
But they did nothing. I think it's best if we start you off with a little diatribe, and then and then I'll come back in and we'll address some of the big issues that it throws up.
Well, I wouldn't say sad. I mean, livid for about Spain, and that was, I think, a disgrace. They deserve to be out. They really deserve to be out. It was absolutely shocking. I mean, the worst part about it is the arrogance of their complacency. I mean, whatever about what happened after the penalty. Basically, Spain were 1-0 up. They were in control. They were 1-0 up without having to do too much. But then worse, they started to behave as if they were 3-0 up and it was the 80th minute. It was a disgrace. And I tweeted about it a few minutes actually before the penalty. I was saying basically that, you know, Spain are so much better than a really, really, really bad Russia. And I don't think we overestimated how poor Russia are. So to some extent their approach is justifiable. But if it's only 1-0, they leave themselves open. And lo and behold, in a tournament where Spain have been characterised above anything else really by sloppiness, by mistakes and just casual nature, they got punished. And then after that, what was particularly weird about the game then after that was that, I mean, we've seen all the passing stats now. We've heard the passing stats as much as we've seen Spain pass the ball about 1,000 times. But, and I've noticed a little bit of debate about kind of Spain's passing approach, tiki-taka and all this, but that's not tiki-taka, that's not what it is. I mean, it did feel as if Spain just kind of got themselves locked into this way of playing, and they kind of stopped believing, they stopped doing everything. Like, they actually, even in some of their sloppy performances earlier in this campaign, they stopped kind of, like, there was no running between the lines. I remember, like, we were sat there today and we were watching, there's quite a high vantage point to Luzhniki. And the massive gap in the area between the 18-yard... or just in front of the 18-yard box. So, like, just behind Costa and between the midfield and Costa, there was no one running into that space. And this is despite a team that's supposed to be defined by three playmakers kind of, you know, interchanging in that area. But then we all, like... Of course, it goes beyond today, and everything stems from what happened before the tournament even began.
I think... there was a moment, it was about the 67th minute. So I remember it went on so long that we were talking during it. You and to my left was Barney Roneau, the Guardian, and we were talking as Spain were camped in the Russian half. It was 1-1 at this point. Spain went ahead through a Sergei Ignashevich own goal very, very early on. And then Russia equalised through a penalty, and that was Gerard Piqué who gave away that with a stupid handball that was given on VAR, but it was a penalty, right?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
So there we go. Goes into the second half. Spain have been the better side in terms of dominance, of course. They had 76% possession in the first half. Gets to the 67th minute, and they were passing the ball back and forth. Basically, they you could even see the 4-3-3, the literal formation that they were playing in, like as they passed the ball around, mm-hmm. because they were just passing it back from side to side across the pitch. Diego Costa was stood kind of on the edge of the mm-hmm. box in the centre. Asensio was stood out on one wing. Isco was stood out on the other. Silva, and I think Iniesta had come on by that point. It might have been Iniesta for Silva. But Isco is on there. Busquets. The centre-backs have stepped up. The full-backs are kind of pushed on. But the ball's just getting passed from side to side. And Russia didn't touch the ball for at least 3 minutes. But it only went sideways. Mm. And the players who didn't have the ball were not moving. They were stood or they were strolling. They were walking to try and find a little bit of space. But then when they did receive the ball, no one ever turned towards goal. No one ever tried to make a forward pass. The ball came to them and they gave it back. And it was basically this absolute, confident, perhaps arrogant belief that if they just kept passing the ball around, that Russia would, I don't know, like open up and present them with a chance. Because what they certainly didn't do themselves is create any chances.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I remember hearing from someone who was at a seminar that Vicente del Bosque did. Talk about Euro 2012 and how they won it without a striker. And he said, well, the point is, what we tried to do was basically move the ball from left to right as fast as possible to create the openings for our midfielders to move into. So, like, people looked at it the wrong way. Whereas this is everything Spain were wrongly getting criticised for before. Like, this was everything bad about Spain, and it was true. The criticism was fully deserved. It was just so passive. They did improve a little bit when Iniesta came on. And then I suppose this goes back to, I mean, Hierro is an impossible situation there. Like, you know, he's not a manager, as it seems. So you can't blame him too much. But again, once Aspas and Rodrigo were brought on, it became clear they should have been on much earlier.
Yeah, and the players that improved them in Aspas and Rodrigo were players who are from outside the system. They are players who bring something different, who change it. And it's because they were willing to run at players and they were willing to do things. Asensio, who I was so looking forward to seeing, and I felt like before the game that, you know, they could spank Russia and that he could have a massive game because he is so talented and he could bring something different to them. And there was no directness, no, like as the Spanish would say, verticality to it, which means exactly what it sounds like, going up the pitch as opposed to going side to side, which was Spain's and probably the entire game. As you said, over 1,000 passes completed.
Only 14 to Diego Costa.
Only 14 to Diego Costa. Few of them going forward.
And Isco
touched the ball around 200 times in that game, which in itself is remarkable. And they dropped Iniesta from the starting lineup for a variety of reasons, but kind of one of them is to make Isco more the focal point of the team and stuff. And he has to take some blame today because, as much as I like him, and he is a terrific player, he was part of the problem today. He didn't make things happen.
There's been a few murmurs from the Spanish camp that a few senior figures thought that were not those from Real Madrid, thought that Isco does too many things for show, that he plays to the crowd rather than playing, as Xavi has apparently said to him in the past, doing what's necessary. And I think that really came across today.
There were times when the ball went forward and because Russia weren't just looking to get everybody behind the ball, and Russia didn't even threaten on the counter-attack really, they were just getting bodies behind the ball. And there were times when Russia, in the first half particularly, had committed a few men forward. The ball gets cleared and there's a nice pass fizzed into Isco. And ahead of him, he's got two or three teammates and there's three or four defenders. So it's a 4-on-4, which is, let's be honest, the best numerical matchup they probably had all game. Hmm. And Isco turned away from goal and passed it backwards. And by the time someone looks up to look forward, again, you've got 11 Russian shirts behind the ball. And that, unfortunately, happened too many times. And the way Spain played today was almost a cowardice. They showed no courage, no bravery, they took no risks because, and it looked like they were scared of Russia on the counter, but Russia looked so unbelievably poor with the ball. And at the end, they were shattered.
Do you remember, there were times, especially in the last 45 minutes of play, which I mean, like, say, 75 minutes on and then into extra time, we were almost laughing. Like, a Russian player would try and control the ball near the Spanish box, and they completely lose it. Like, they were so knackered that all technique had deserted them. That they weren't able for the level. But the one thing I should say, actually, I mean, as a half Spaniard and all, I'm kind of, there's this maybe regret that they somehow got themselves on the easy side of the draw, despite actually messing up the game against Morocco as well. So they got to here, on the easy side of the draw, and you think, they wasted such a great chance to get to the World Cup. Yet, they were the biggest name left that side of the draw, and yet, after that, and even as underwhelming as Croatia were against Denmark, I don't think I'd fancy Spain. Having watched that and having watched the Morocco game, and despite having been impressed with them in the first game against Portugal, I'm not sure they would have beaten Croatia. I think Croatia would have been favourites, and England would have punished that defence today.
That's what I was thinking on the way out, is that they were so scared of that Russian counter-attack. Because Piqué and Ramos haven't been themselves, they're so scared of that Russian counter-attack. Imagine what Sterling and Kane would have done to them. I think they're... As I say, it was the cowardice towards the end, where if you trust in the process, which is how Spain play, Spain are trusting in their process that if we keep the ball and dominate the ball like they did, and the way they dominated the ball was almost unprecedented, like 80% possession. If you trust in that process to dominate the ball, then you have to keep ramping up the attack. You have to keep turning things up and trying to create and take risk, because you know that if you're trusting the process, you've only got up until 120 minutes in this case. If it goes to extra time, it goes to 120 minutes. You looked at 90 minutes before extra time, and the Russians were all on the floor. Spain were okay, because they knackered the Russians out, which again is part of the point of playing like this. So you've got half an hour, and you have to keep cranking it up and keep taking more risks, because if you do that and you've got the ball, you've got maybe a 70%, 80% chance of winning. As soon as it goes to penalties, it's not quite 50-50 because of technique, but it's a 55-45. And you absolutely have to take some risks and do something, and they just didn't do it.
Yeah, it was basically, to sum it up, there was too much process, not enough product. And it is almost comes back to actually a bit of a kind of a philosophical point of football. But and like I say, and you sometimes see it in, say, statistical arguments, or some of the debate around XG, which is not to say that, not again diminish a valuable statistical tool, but it's almost like, say a team has dominated a game but just not scoring. Oh, it's just a freak of the game. Sometimes it's just bad luck. But and like basically the process is right, but that's not always right, because sometimes football is ultimately, because it's such a game of such small scores, it's ultimately about winning. There still comes a point where you have to actually go and do it. You have to execute. You have to produce. Now, and Spain just didn't do that. They didn't deliver. They didn't step up. Now, in saying that as well, it'll actually be quite interesting to see what their stats are for that game in terms of, because they didn't really create many clear cut chances until Iniesta came on.
No, I thought really they were, when it came to creating chances, they were pathetic. Like, I can't think of many clear chances they actually did. Like, who else do they have? Who else do they have to Costa? Did Costa have a single shot? I'm just trying to find.
But he only passed the ball 14 times. But actually, Costa spent most of the game. Basically, like, he was surrounded by five defenders.
I've found the XG map for Spain-Russia.
From Michael Cayley.
And, thanks to Michael Cayley from this over in America. Spain had 1.5 expected goals, a rough sum, from the kind of pot shots and stuff they had. They scored an own goal, obviously, and they never looked like conceding. And that's the thing, really, is that...
That's where he was really kicking themselves.
That's why they had to keep pushing and had to keep going, and they had to try new things. And there are players that never got on the field, like Odriozola. Why did Nacho play at right back against Russia when Odriozola's there? If you're not going to go with Carvajal, Odriozola is the attacking fullback option. And Nacho is a centre-back playing out of position. A versatile centre-back, fine. And he plays for Real Madrid. But and this might be, I think, where Hierro comes in. And we have to talk about this, because I guess this is what the campaign will be remembered for more than anything, is the difference between Hierro and Lopetegui. And, you know, it's easy to ask this question now, and I probably can guess what you're going to say, but do you think they win this game with Julen Lopetegui in charge?
This is something that really should haunt everyone involved, particularly Lopetegui and to a certain extent, I suppose, Florentino Perez, although he really only cares about Real Madrid. You know, for years, they should have... They'll always think what might have been. I mean, I'm still not sure how good a manager Lopetegui is, but it was obvious that he was the right fit for that team, and he clearly done things with the team that suited him, and they were kind of ticking along very nicely. So first of all, you lose that, and then secondly, there's the extra effect of the massive blow up of it happening so close to the tournament, which, you know, they get hit in two ways there.
But when Hierro came in, I remember we had this discussion, and our biggest concern was. In-game, we thought the personnel wouldn't change that much. It's in-game decisions, substitutions, tweaks, that we felt Lopetegui would be better at than Hierro. And the knock on Hierro from his time with Oviedo and I guess from other things that people knew about him, was that he's naturally conservative.
Mm.
And that's surely the best description of what we saw today.
Yeah, completely, completely. Yeah, and also you'd wonder about, like, one of the other things is conservative in another sense as well, that it would take him a long time to make changes to his team, even though it was clear that something, and it was the case today, it was summed up by the fact that Rodrigo and Aspas came on far too late.
I think it's a shame for Spain to go out like that.
I just think, I mean, I've written this in my piece, it's coming out on Monday morning, but I mean, when a team suffers a defeat as calamitous as that in a tournament, sort of a profile as a World Cup, usually the immediate instinct is to kind of, I mean, we see it so much with England, I suppose, these deep philosophical debates about what's wrong with our team, what's wrong with the, is something wrong with the philosophy, but that's just not needed with Spain, because we know what the central issue is, and that's what makes it all the more calamitous, because really, I mean, to go out to that Russian team is lamentable.
What do you think they'll do? Do you think Hierro, it's hard to see Hierro stay in place. One of the in-house option that was kind of overlooked for this World Cup, it suggests that he probably won't get it, is Albert Salades.
A colleague did say to me, he WhatsApped me during the game, saying basically some of this might be on Rubiales, not in the sense of getting rid of Lopetegui, because I think we both, myself and this guy, agree that he was put in an impossible situation and going to have to act. But he had 24 hours to think about his decision. Maybe he should have gone for a proper coach rather than someone that was almost like a company suit in Hierro.
Yeah. I mean, it would be like England putting Dan Ashworth in charge if Gareth Southgate had quit for taking the Chelsea job the day before or whatever.
It's actually, when you consider it, it's an amazing and ridiculous situation. And I think, and I do wonder whether now Spanish media will start to turn on Real Madrid a bit.
Well, only half of it will. Let's be honest. They know which side their bread is buttered.
Who is it? It's someone ass who are obviously they're less pro Madrid than. Ass who are less pro Madrid than
they are still very pro Madrid, but
so yeah, Matianas and ass he goes to Real Madrid. He talks about it's one of the worst crises this federation has faced, in a ridiculous situation where a Spanish club is sabotaging the squad on the eve of the World Cup.
I think this is going to bleed into next season, because that's how it works in Spain, and Real Madrid, like, you know, there'll be a little bit of quiet now. Well, probably not, actually, given the thing. One of the main things in the Madrid sports press is they've got two sport-only newspapers, and they have to fill their pages every day. And a lot of that is Real Madrid content, you know. So what's going to happen is this now turns into a Lopetegui Real Madrid story as well. Yeah. Like, once the Spain thing has died down and the players are on holiday, it has to turn into a Lopetegui Real Madrid thing. So there will be more to come on this, and I do think, you know, I said, well, you know, we had, me and you had very different views when it happened. I thought they should have stuck with Lopetegui and not sacked him. You thought he had to go.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still think that?
Yes, I think on principle. But
I mean, that's when. That's why they said they sacked him. Yeah. It was valores, they said, which was values, ethics, I mean, the only way is ethics, as they say. So I think Spain had to, they had to stand by their decision. They've stood by it, and there are people that are going to be blamed. Rubiales, I think, so early into his reign to have that decision to make is obviously a very difficult situation. But he's clearly a strong guy. Like, he came out straight after the kickoff as well. Kickoff came after the result, and he spoke. You know, he's fronted up, like he gave the face, as they say in Spanish,
and
I think one of the big things in the Spanish media is that they appreciate that more than anything. If he had hidden, if he'd waited till tomorrow, they would have kind of been allowed to simmer with anger about it and all that sort of thing. He was immediately out there and talking about it, and I think there will be some changes. Iniesta retired from international football. I don't think there's anything more we can add really to what he's done in his career. He scored the winning goal in a World Cup final.
At the very least, not that I have much compensation for him tonight, and much consolation, his last act in international football was to score. It was a penalty.
Yes, it was. And, you know, he goes, Sergio Ramos said he's absolutely not going. I think he was he's probably a little bit young. He was asked, and he's, what, 31? But he said, he'll carry on till Qatar, even if he's got grey hairs in his beard. he said it, the pain, it was the pain from this that is going to drive him on. And I think, you know, really, my piece I wrote that was that this performance was almost, the way that they couldn't quite get the balance right, it was almost like they were stuck between two generations of the Spanish team. That they had the really successful youth players under Lopetegui at the same time as the senior team was winning the World Cup and the European Championships. And what they've tried to do is blend the two together. And the Iniesta-Isco thing not quite working is the perfect example of those two generations not quite meshing together. And would Isco have functioned better if he had Saúl and Koke alongside him rather than Busquets and Silva, for example? And I think the answer is probably yes.
Yeah.
You know, so we could see, depending on who comes in as coach, and I think the tempting, interesting choice would be Quique Setién, although it would be a shame to see his Real Betis sort of project. I know people don't like that word in England, but it's a good word. The Real Betis project kind of stopped now. I don't think he'd want to take it for that reason, but he's a very good Spanish coach. Paco Gémez has been linked, which would be, a disastrous appointment, but it'll be interesting to see what direction they take it in. They've obviously got an abundance of incredible quality players, so I don't think that's going to be a problem in the same way that Argentina might have a little bit of a drying up of the pipeline of talent and quality coming their way. But Spain did lose, so we should mention the winners.
But see, this is the weird thing about it. I mean, and I said this when I tweeted out my piece earlier. I was actually writing, I was conscious, I have to kind of bring in more praise for Russia here. But like, it was so on Spain that it was so difficult to go back to Russia, because Russia did so little. Like, now I suppose what they did was enough. They just stood there. Because
that's not quite fair. They to defend, you don't just stand there. But Spain's immobility didn't mean they didn't need to do much more than that.
This is the thing, basically. That Russian wall wasn't moving, but that was also because Spain's attack wasn't moving.
Yeah. So it really was about being coached positionally quite well. And so Chernetsov, the coach, probably deserves some credit for that. The penalty, they scored it. Well done. But they just did so little outside that. They barely created a chance. They had one or two counters where they had kind of three-on-three sort of situations, and they didn't know what to do in those situations. They were dead. They were just so dead after 90 minutes. And that's why I couldn't believe that Spain didn't really turn up the volume. You know, we said afterwards, it was like, you know, if it was a siege on a castle, you know, because there have been games, and old Spain games, when Spain were at their prime, that peak, where it was like a siege, where you're kind of, you've got the team penned in their own box, and then you just get inching them closer and closer and closer. It's like a boa constrictor strangling the team. Yeah. But this wasn't like that. This was like, you know, you said it. It was like if you had a castle under siege, this was just like passing the cannonball from one soldier to another.
Yeah. Also, I mean, that the other thing that stood out, I think I've gone on about this in a few of our podcasts, but I watched that documentary about the 2010 World Cup before we came over. And what really stands out, I mean, in all Spain were so good at that point that in every single defence, every single game, they played these massive, they were really intense matches. And they had to work so hard to kind of break these teams down. But there was that greater drive about them. Just not, and you don't sense it with this team. They don't have. I mean, the players aren't as good. I mean, let's be fair. With that Spain team, we're probably talking about the most complete international side of all time, right down to the way that if you're trying to dream of a striker that so perfectly fit the way they played, but yet gave them something different, you couldn't have a better one than David Villa. So they were almost the perfect international team, whereas this is not. But it's a much looser team.
And if they had a player like David Villa today, they probably would have won that handily, actually. It is curious, because after the Portugal game, we kind of thought they might have found the solution to their ongoing number nine problem that's basically been around since Villa left. And I think today Costa showed so little. And he showed so little the other day in that final group game where, again, Ramos pointed out that they leave the World Cup without having lost a game. But they also never really super impressed anyone.
They only won one game. And that arguably, and that, it was deserved because it should have been ruled out. But they came down to VAR helping them. So they got away with it. Like, had VAR not there, it could have been a lot worse of a tournament for Spain. And Iran gave them problems that winning the defeat anyway.
Yeah, so as you might have worked out, Spain are out of the World Cup. It does make that side of the draw even weaker. There are reports coming in from England that football might be coming home. More on that as we get it. But Russia progress, and they will be playing against Croatia in the next round. After Croatia prevailed on penalties, dramatic scenes at the end of extra time. Basically, the two early goals, which were like Sunday League goals, like dreadful, including the terrible goalkeeping from Subasic, but eventually become the hero in the penalty shootout. Then, end of extra time, Miguel, Ante Rebic is through on goal. He's past Kasper Schmeichel, and he gets hacked down by a defender with an open goal in front of him. It's only a yellow card because of the new rule. He gets a penalty. Luka Modric steps up, and Kasper Schmeichel saves the penalty. Is that adequate punishment for the crime?
Not if the penalty is saved.
So you agree with my proposal that that should be upgraded to a red if the penalty is missed?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, although, well, actually, we're into problematic waters there because...
Well, we are, but...
Because then it could give an incentive to...
To miss the penalty.
Yeah, or to let a penalty in. Maybe the rule should basically... If he has an open goal like that, the player... It shouldn't be a penalty, it should be a penalty goal.
I think that might be the best way around it, the penalty goal. Like, you can say that there's a chance the player could have missed it. You know, we've seen players miss that when there's a defender not there. But the fact is, he was fouled and he would have scored. And he didn't. If Croatia had gone out, you can imagine what the reaction would have been like back home. In Zagreb, it would have been... Like they, it would have been a huge kind of look at the rules and everything. It would have provoked an interesting debate.
One thing about that, I think Schmeichel was off his line for the penalty, as Boki was aware of trying to shoot out. A lot of people talk about great bottle for Modric. Say great sporting courage to step up. I thought he actually almost, I mean, in real terms, he almost bottled his penalty too. He got very, very lucky, Schmeichel. So he bottled the second penalty. Yeah, he got very, very lucky that Schmeichel
didn't just catch it.
Yeah.
There were some good penalties, a lot of bad ones, a lot of saves. Subasic and Schmeichel really acquitted themselves rather brilliantly in that shootout. Jakub Brook is there, but it's so late in, where is he, Nizhny Novgorod, that I can't guarantee we'll talk to him. So this is a conditional. If I can get hold of him, then I'll tack it on the end here. If not, then that's all you're going to hear about Croatia-Denmark. But outside the penalty shootout, it wasn't that good a game. So that side of the draw opens up a little, Miguel. Croatia versus Russia. And then the other quarterfinal will be England or Colombia against Sweden or Switzerland.
But this is the one thing we're saying about, and it's one thing maybe to keep in consideration for all the talk about England side of the draw. Because we have these presumptions then, like, oh, Croatia will beat Russia. England, if they took on Sweden, Switzerland, we'd fancy their chances, fair enough. But this tournament's proving nothing's gone to plan.
Would Croatia beat that massed Russian defence?
Yes, I think.
But would they? Spain couldn't break it down.
Well, I think the Spain situation today, well, it's unique and more down to some weird neurosis with Spain and what the game became rather than anything to do with Russia.
Do you think that there should have been the penalty given? I've just remembered this in the Spain-Russia game, the one where it appeared that Ramos and Piqué were being hauled down from that cross. It went to VAR and wasn't given. In real time, in the stadium, looking at it, I could see that the defender had his shirt because he was stretching his shirt out. So for me, immediately I'm thinking it's a penalty because... You know, he's got a huge handful of his shirt and Ramos goes to the ground.
Yeah, I thought it was a penalty at the time. I think, on reflection now, I can see that a ref wouldn't give it. Which is fair enough.
Fair enough, yeah. It needs to be clear or whatever. But I like to think that it would be even-handed, but sometimes I think like the host nation just gets a little... They get a little home advantage.
But this wasn't like Spain with Korea in 2002.
No, it wasn't ludicrous. It wasn't ludicrous. It was a marginal call. So what games have we got tomorrow? So tomorrow you're off to...
I'm getting up in a... as we record this podcast, 4 hours and 40 minutes. So,
well, considering you delayed my departure the other day by playing Sporkle quizzes against
That was Johnny Lou. That was
Who was playing against him?
Yeah, but like, you know, I didn't know what time you were going. He was the one going with you.
Which led to my odyssey. You are off to Brazil versus Mexico. In Samara. A quick chat on that. What do you think? What are you expecting?
I think you would have fancied Mexico more, but then they completely collapsed in that game against Sweden, which kind of...
I'm telling you, Sweden might be good.
Sweden are good, yeah. They've already counted for Germany, Netherlands and Italy on the way here, even if they didn't beat Germany, but they topped the group that Germany finished bottom of. And I think Mexico also, I think facing Brazil, I can see them having a bit of an emotional breakdown in this game, and I think Brazil will solidly win by 2-0.
I think Brazil are the best team at this tournament, and I wholeheartedly agree. Chicha, again, he was asked about the expectations of this team, you know, and all the stupid questions that he gets asked, and as is his way, he's calm, he's methodical. He said, expectations are nothing, I live in reality. This is a team that is improving every game, and that's all I want to see. And that is all he wants to see, and they have improved every game. And that the Coutinho and Neymar, Gabriel Jesus axis looks really good. Whenever those three kind of get close to each other, it really works. Jesus is getting some criticism for not having scored a goal, but watch them play. He's very key in everything they do. He presses from the front, and the squad love him because of the energy he brings at the front, which I think obviously Roberto Firmino would bring, but it sounds like Firmino doesn't really have a chance. It sounds like Jesus has certainly got the backing of the entire squad. And I guess the other round of 16 game tomorrow must be
it's Belgium
against Japan, which is in Rostov-on-Don. That will be an interesting game, no doubt, but you'd expect Belgium, it's two good ball playing teams. It actually might be quite an entertaining game of football, but Japan have more than enough cracks, and Belgium have cracks in the Spanish sense. They've got so many good players.
That's a bit. But I still have Belgium 2-3-1, I'd say.
Yeah. Thank you, Miguel. I know you need to go to bed. There's a chance I speak to Jack in a second. If so, then hi, Jack. What did you think of that?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi Ed, it's Jack. I'm outside the Nizhny Novgorod Stadium. It's 2:15 in the morning. Just left the mix zone after a game which was kind of a strange game, really. It kind of veered from kind of high drama and farce at the start to basically like 110 minutes of very, very boring, bad football, which you might as well fast forward it if you had that capacity. Like, it was really, there was kind of nothing there. Like, the two teams cancelled each other out. I thought Croatia were probably slightly better. The game turned when Denmark brought on Lasse Schürrle at half-time for Andreas Christensen, who very effectively shut down Croatia and didn't let them through. And it looked all the while like it was definitely going for penalties. And then, on 115 minutes, one brilliant Modric pass cut open Denmark. Modric took the penalty, missed it, Then the game went to penalties, and of course Croatia won. But what I thought was really interesting was that, was one, like, it's a huge deal for Modric personally, because he had a, you know, to miss that penalty, then 15 minutes later to get a chance to reverse that, score the crucial penalty and win, you know, which was part of Croatia winning the game, was really good. And lots of, and the manager actually spoke afterwards about when Croatia beat Turkey, when Croatia lost to Turkey in Euro 2008, when famously I think Ivan Klasnic scored in about 119 minutes, Croatia thought they'd won the game, Turkey equalised with the last kick of added on time and at the end of extra time, Croatia were broken by this and Turkey beat them on pens. And they kind of reversed that in a way today, in the sense they overcame that setback at the end of extra time and won on the penalty shootout. And now, for the first time in ages, Croatia are in the quarterfinals and they're looking good. I mean, they didn't play brilliantly today, but I think the lesson in this World Cup really is you don't need to play brilliantly every time. Like, France were pretty awful for their three group games, and you now have to say they're looking very good for the semis or maybe beyond that. Like, Croatia don't have a difficult draw. They have Russia in the quarterfinals, and I know Russia won surprisingly against Spain today, but Russia are not a good team. And I think that given the quality that Croatia have and the character, if they can just find a little bit more confidence and belief off the back of today, then you'd have to bat them to beat Russia and go through to the semis. Are they the best team in this half of the draw? I mean, we'll have to wait and see what happens to England-Colombia on Tuesday night in Moscow, where I'm flying tomorrow. But, I mean, I'd certainly, putting everything together, I wouldn't want England to play Croatia. If England did play Croatia, I think that England would have a less than 50-50 chance of winning the game. Just because this Croatia team's got so much more experience in international level, they've been playing together for years, even though they haven't been getting the results. And that's why I'd be pretty, if I was Croatian, I'd be pretty bullish about their chances now, even though they nearly lost the shootout in, you know, Kasper Schmeichel was very good for Denmark, as always. Croatia didn't really create that much in open play. Because, like I said, I think this is a World Cup which is probably about luck, belief and momentum more than it is about consistent high-level performance. Because, you know, frankly, nobody's delivering consistent high-level performance, if we're honest. We're just getting kicked out of the media centre here because it's so late. So, I thought that was a pretty positive day, really. And quite an exciting game, given that it was so boring for almost 2 hours of it.
It was an eventful day at Russia 2018, as they all seem to be these days. And we'll talk tomorrow, where Miguel will check in from Samara.
I'll probably part from Samara.
Yes,
you're going to brush my teeth.
He's off to brush his teeth, and then we'll do Samara, and then I'll also have Mark Critchley here tomorrow. I think Johnny's around, and we're previewing England Colombia, the big one, to verify if it is indeed returning to its house.